Hello and welcome to What the Lux with me, Fred Moore,
and me, Anand Sharma.
Together we lead Matterform, a design consultancy specializing in brand, digital experience and content. And this is a podcast that calls time on tired ideas of luxury.
Alongside industry luminaries and thought leaders, we explore what truly defines category-leading products and services.
Welcome to the podcast, Lizzie Day and Tim Butcher. In 2005, they founded Fromental, establishing their reputation with hand-painted, hand-embroidered silk wall coverings. 20 years later, and they've dived headfirst into other mediums of decoration too, exploring everything from artworks to textiles. At the heart of their success is an appreciation that this superlative craftsmanship leads to beauty that enriches life, in the visual manifestation of the art form, of course, but equally the stories that go behind it. And fascinatingly, from Matterform's perspective, they don't stand still. They believe cutting-edge tech, when used with the correct intent, can be just as remarkable. In their words, craftsmanship to us means good use of tools and technology. You must remember, painting onto silk was high-tech at one time. So welcome both. Welcome, Lizzie and Tim, to the podcast. Thanks for coming in today. The obvious first question we have to ask is, please just tell us, what is Fromental? What do you do? What's the product?
Well, we started by making hand-painted wall coverings, panoramic. That doesn't mean it's a scene of, you know, bucolic hills. It means that the design doesn't repeat and it goes from left to right as you evolve around the room. And the reason we chose that particular niche is that we were young upstarts, and the only way you can position yourself when you have nothing to lose and nothing to start with is at the highest end. We had craftsmanship, we had the skills, and we had access to incredible painters and materials. And so we really started by making wall coverings, which were impossible to make in any other means than hand painting.
And presumably not by accident. Where did you find these incredible artisans? Did you previously have these relationships, a history there?
My background is I'm a weaver by training, and I worked in the world of fashion. And through that, I ended up traveling to China, working with embroiderers there and working with hand painters using traditional Chinese painting to hand paint fabrics for couturiers. That was back in the 90s. And in so doing, I really fell in love with traditional Chinese painting and the history of Chinese painted wallpaper, which has a very long history. And working with those artists for many years and really immersing myself into that medium is when, through no real specific choice, became an expert in that area, but had these connections with those artists. So when we had a vision to start our own business with our own aesthetic, those relationships were in place in China.
Did you know there would be people would want this? What was the state of affairs in 2005?
Well, I mean, I learned the details of this particular craft working for another interiors house who made Chinese wallpaper. And there's a heritage to that kind of wallpaper, which goes back 270 years. And so there's a rich tradition within design for this form of wallpaper. And it's really, ever since the first imports in the 1750s or so, it's never really fully gone out of fashion. So there's always an appetite for it in a particular part of the market. What we felt was that rather than this sort of reproduction, references to traditional great houses, there's a capability and an appetite for something far more contemporary and far more up-to-date and just very, very new and different, as built on that tradition. And so I'd been working with designers and clients who already had a love for this. So I knew the market was there.
And what's the working dynamic? Are you both designers by background? Are you still both designing?
Tim was having a play with some crayons yesterday. I did help him by bringing some tracing paper and a black pen to, you know, put the design on top. No, but that joking aside, I do have the privileged position of mainly working in the design daily. And
I mean, I think the fact that I was a weaver, it's more about, okay, there's an idea. How do we make it? What more can we do with it? How do you use the materials? How do they interplay? So we've always been a good team or double act in design in that sense, where I've got a good insight into what a good design will be and how it will work. And Liz's execution is second to none. And so those two things played together, you know, and the different layers of, of the processes involved, the colours, the materials, as well as the graphic form.
Which, I mean, that's fascinating because design is obviously, the skill of design is contextual, and there's no mono definition of what makes a good designer. So what I'm hearing is that together, the sum of what you offer is perhaps greater than your no doubt individual talents.
Yeah, I completely agree. When it comes to Fromontana, the work we do there, I think that my work would be a little flat if it didn't have that sort of little breath of what Tim can bring to it. And Tim will, although he's a way better colourist than me, will sometimes bring a design that he's worked on and coloured, and just to find a different, maybe off-skew perspective on colour, where I'll add another colour to it that he might not have thought of. And it's not because either of us are better, it's just because we come fresh to an idea. And we do respect each other's choices. There will be a grumble. I think there's that delicious tension when you've worked on something that you're quite proud of and somebody comes up behind you and, like a backseat driver, says, you could have... And you just have that feeling that you have to let go and go, yeah, actually, you're right.
It's you can imagine Lennon McCartney having a bit of the same thing.
There has to be that tension. It's not just...
But there's a grudging respect.
But it's only with the grudging respect can you actually listen. Will you listen to that advice, which does allow... The thing is, when you're working on a design, there's a sort of tunnel vision that can happen where you're so fixated on what you brought to the design that you're starting... You're no longer seeing the other possibilities. And so to have somebody else there to bring that in...
You've got to break the ego. It's really nice. It's really, really nice. And it does allow you to work as you evolve. I mean, we're only 20 years into this. Hopefully, both of us will have long careers in design or creation. You know, that is the ideal. You know, you do get better as you get older. That's the joy of it. But you get to a point when you can easily shed the ego and you willingly shed the ego to work collaboratively. And that's really exciting. And that's why, you know, we love working with other artists and also our clients. It's that delightful shedding of ego that allows you to really make something beautiful.
Yeah, and I want to talk a bit later about those collaborations or partnerships. Can I just come back to what drives you both? We'll also talk about the business side of this, but actually just the raw fundamental motivation in doing this. You seem to center around this idea of beauty, which is quite simple, and how beauty enriches people's lives if they're lucky enough to experience it. Is that a fair statement?
It's a necessity. I think anybody who's in the creative field, whether it's a musician, an artist, a writer, an actor, they have to. It's compulsive. You have to do it. There is no other way. There is nothing else. For me, that is quite simple. There is nothing else more joyous. We have a very small parenthesis to live within. But other people are really good at contributing other things to the world. I make wallpaper.
Beauty is fundamental in that sense, but I think it's the creativity which feels like it's innate. The desire and the joy of seeing it happen, making it happen, bringing it into being. And then if it is beautiful and it is good and there is a quality to it, it's enriching on a personal level in an incredibly joyous way. And you know that you're turning that outwards. If you are creating something beautiful, you are doing something good. It's that feeling and bringing that into the world. You know, it's that creative process is, as Lizzie says, it's a necessity. It's not a choice to do it. It is what we do.
And that goes back millennia. Well, humans have that absolute need to express something artistically.
The challenge you bring to it then is, how do you make it work in the world on a very mundane, commercial, nuts and bolts way? We have to live. We have, you know, there's a necessity to earn money. We have to earn our crust. To do that in a way which is through something which is innately good for you is a very happy space to be. However, you know, those challenges and the frictions involved in making it work commercially and practically are, you know, that's part of the process.
Unquestionably, you can pick up the creative ethos, the purity that sits there, but you are a successful business. You're a very well-known business. That can't have been easy. Did you set out to make this as big a business as it's become? What are the compromises you've had to make on the way? How do you feel about those compromises?
Challenging. We didn't set out to be, I know it's almost a trite sort of trope that, you know, bigger is not necessarily better. But equally, to do some of the things that we do, there's a necessity of a degree of scale. You know, if we were both making beautiful wallpapers, working from commission to commission, you could make it work. A room of one of our, you know, pieces inspired by traditional Chinese painting, it's 40 hours to paint a panel. A dining room, maybe 20 panels, so that's 800 hours. So in order to make that work commercially, how many artists do you need to be able to deliver that in an agile enough way to make it commercially good? So all of those things are things I've got to grips with over the last 20 years. So our desire to grow and to scale is actually to reach a point of health for the company as much as anything else.
And it's a balance of what you can deliver in a viable way. Yes, we could deliver the most astonishing wallpaper anybody could have has ever seen using the most skilled craftsman, spending months on each panel. Of course we could. But as a designer, again, we love parameters. We love strict parameters. If the parameter is make something extremely beautiful that will meet this cost in this time scale, that's exciting.
We've not tried to drive down to that. We've always had the driving ethos is, what does it take to make it well? It must be good. You know, if it takes 25 or 30 hours to paint a panel, if you try to aim, what can we make in 15, try and make it in 15, your motivation is wrong.
But you can find something else.
There are other things you can make, but you've got to use the right amount of time. So you've got to maintain your high standards in terms of quality, not just in terms of immediate execution, but is this the right way to make the best product? So anyway, we come around in different ways for that. But I think that that drive for scale, there's a point where one has to be in order to be healthy as a business and as an organization. After 20 years, I'm still struggling and trying to find exactly that right point. What was clear is that if you're going to be very niche, you need to be very international. So therefore, you have another necessity. Then you need to be international. You need to bring that into your organization. But because you're targeting such a small niche percentage of the market, to go global is the only way that you'll find all of those people. So all of those things deliver a scale of organization that must be in place in order to be able to operate. The number of artists that you need to be able to deliver this. So there's a defined, you can't be too small if you want to do this. So, and that's what's really driven us to have to build a company or an organization of the scale that it is now. And then concomitant to that, therefore, you need to have a wide enough audience. So the brand necessities come into it and the marketing necessities through all sorts of different needs and factors. So I'm sort of waffling around a few points there, but they all define why we need and want Fromental to be this bigger established business, if you like. It's not a drive for maximum scale. Absolutely not. It's a necessity for a certain degree of quality, which we inherently want to achieve.
It'd be fascinating at this point to talk about how it goes from the creation of the idea to production or to how it's made and then finally into someone's home. What's that journey?
Well, it starts principally in the design studio in London. So whether it's a client order or a new design for our collection, we'll work on it in the studio, myself and the wonderful team that we have of designers. And the first sampling, the first principle of design will be executed in London, the idea, the layout, and then it goes with Tim's able hands and mind to China or the print studios.
There's a huge editing process in terms of consistently, is this a good design, the number which don't go forward. Once the concept is there and this is something we want to do, the next phase is, how do we make it? Can we make it? Is it reproducible? Have we got control? Can those skills and the particular techniques translate to our production studios, whether it be hand painting, embroidery, or print? So, and there's quite a rigorous step there where we ensure that it's practical, effectively.
The bit that's the bit that's the artisan in China, how do you communicate? What's the quality control mechanism for that between those people and yourself? And how does that work?
There's 40 artists, different skills, but in groups with some fairly consistent skills. The wonderful thing about traditional Chinese painting is you learn the same forms, techniques. So there's a reproducibility inherent in the training of being an artist. Whereas if you took five people who graduated from the Slade and asked them to paint the same thing, they're all going to be different. So you have a set of skills and abilities which are fairly understood and spread across all of the artists. There are different skills inside of that. We communicate it. What we've built with our studios and how we communicate and work with those and the controls is a key part of what we do, a really key part. And we've built a language which is very much visual of strokes, techniques, styles, and color. And so I communicate, we do most of it electronically. Where there's something complex, physical pieces to work from and visual is a key to it. And over the time, we've built a lexicon of styles, motifs, techniques, which come through the collections. And we tend to reference each other to make sure that we know what we're trying to work towards.
Well, that's wonderful. So, I mean, you have your own private language.
Absolutely necessary because...
Do you speak Chinese? Or Mandarin?
We don't. Luckily, the manager and some of the head artists and head of teams do speak English very well. Sometimes when I used to go there a lot, worked with the head artist who spoke absolutely no English. I spoke absolutely no Chinese. Yeah. We would share jokes and laugh uproariously. I don't know how. We just did. We drew jokes. So our language is very visual when we put instructions together as well.
It must be so interesting as well, because China is, of course, probably the most misunderstood country in the world. I mean, it's huge for a start. And I think if you read politics, you can ignore the rich, rich cultural diversity in that country. Do you feel you have a take on China that is unique and different from others?
I think that when anyone travels and spends time and meets people from cultures, you understand more about the culture, but most importantly, you connect with the people. So I think we have gained a different insight than you will ever see in the way that things are presented via news and politics, etc. So there is an insight into the political scenarios and day-to-day life. But the key thing when you travel to places, you connect with the people. During COVID, I couldn't go for 3 years when normally I'd be in China at least every 2 months. And so you're communicating all of these things and designs and what we need to make for all of these things through nothing but the digital realm. And it was wonderful to go back because I'd realized I'd started to be colored in my picture of China through only perceiving it or through primarily perceiving it through the media again, despite a long history of having traveled. The moment I got back on the ground, you see, you connect with the people, you forget that, you pick up the nuances, the differences, and you realize this is 1.5 billion people, individuals, living their lives you can connect with easily and innately when you spend time with. The Chinese becomes an individual. And I think one of the reasons why international travel and connection is so important for the future is that it stops us grouping things together into an image which has absolutely zero nuance.
And that's clearly part of the story, which is part of the value. It's the beauty, of course, but this, as we talked about at the beginning, you know, that the story behind it, when I stand on a rug that's taken someone a year, 2 years of their life to make, that's of infinitely more interest to me than something that's been made off a production line. I'm totally fascinated as well, but you talk about values. There must be times when you say no. And without being specific, that'd be an unfair question. When do you say no?
Most of the times, and that we have to say no because the expectations are unrealistic. That's the most simple no. Yeah. Are they ethical no's? I think there have been a few. Yeah. I think there are some points where you cannot accept a project, and it's always done very with great courtesy. And usually, another excuse is given as to why we cannot undertake this project.
Been one or two of those. One, because when you think if you're working at the kind of value or cost involved at times, I know the couple which you're thinking of particularly. I think the ones where it's no on a value, on a sort of more creative value level are, again, we pride ourselves and we only want to do things when we can really do it well and to the best of our ability and it's the right solution. If somebody comes with a design brief, which is, it's just not going to work, it's going to fail, we're not the right people to do it, these aren't the right tools, it doesn't suit that technique.
We don't mind failing, but on our own terms.
We don't mind failing on our own terms, but if somebody comes to you with a request, it's like, that's not a good idea. But I would say we wouldn't do that on a taste level.
Which is business conditions, and that's antennae, and that's skills you develop over time. Then you just don't want to go back to those places you've been before. So it'd be very interesting if you just tell us an example of a project, just to contextualise something that's live or recently done.
Very recently, I think we had a very exciting departure into fashion. Tim, of course, worked in fashion a long time ago, but I just worked on the accessories. But we had a wonderful, unexpected, deep dive, headfirst, breakneck speed project with Harris Reed. And we've been working with him on something else. And he mentioned that in his demi-couture shows, he likes to use and repurpose fabrics, which were for either, furnishings, and asked us if we had any offcuts of hand-embroidered wool coverings. And we were delighted to be able to produce many because we were clearing out our warehouse. And we found these beautiful pieces, which could have, preciously sat on a shelf, but we just gave them to him and his team, and they transformed them into these extraordinary creations that went down the catwalk at Tate Britain.
And they were pieces which we'd loved from 2007, 2009. The actual pieces being used to create these pieces. And Harris, who is delightful, gorgeous. It was such a fun, joyous project. Project-wise for wallpaper, we have a really fun collaboration, which has been coming up 10 years now with the Goring Hotel, when we made one of the most fun commissions we've made in 2015 for their lobby. And they've recently redoing the dining room. So we've been producing another custom piece, which we'll be installing there next week. And the Goring for us, we don't have a showroom in London. The Goring has become this really fun showcase with the sort of classicism and eccentricity, which are really lovely parts of what we do and so British.
And you talk about taste, so you're not going to impose your taste on the client, the customer necessarily, but if you go back 20 years, what are some of the collaborations and partnerships which now you're doing or have done that would really surprise you?
They are so varied. We are lucky to have some collaborations which are collaborations with other craftsmen or other companies which make beautiful things. They are joyous. Equally, working with a designer who has a very clear vision of what they would like to express in a wall covering, and we really respect that designer, even if their field is so different from ours, that also can be joyous. Every single one, as Tim has said, has been made with the intention of making a lovely design at the end of it. So they do come from different fields. There are some that I have found more nourishing than others because I've been more involved in them. And also I've got to meet the people who are involved in it. And I notably think of people who have been craftsmen themselves.
Well, I think the language is easier. The shared values are more directly connected. In other cases, although we don't judge on taste, we have a very strong taste of our own. It's quite a wide gamut of taste because we appreciate very many different styles. And some collaborations, it's interesting at times to work with a designer who has an insight and an understanding into an important sector of the market, which isn't our taste. And yet, it is a lot of other people's taste. So at times, there's commercial necessity that the best way we would fail to design some of those things because our own aesthetic is a lot bolder, probably has a little bit more flair. And by necessity, that is more alienating to a large percentage of the design market. We are designers for designers. We have to offer a wide set of tastes for all the markets where there is an opportunity for us, commercial hat on. And at times, we would be bad at designing that. It's far better to connect with somebody who completely gets that aesthetic. And then our job is to do it as well as we can. And that's the same thing if you have an end client who's got a brief, which you go, okay, well, I wouldn't put poodles in it, but if you want poodles, we'll do the best poodles we can.
It's back to this compromise of some creative humility, or you wouldn't have a business.
Absolutely. Whereas I think that what needs to guide you on that is we're going to do it as damn well as we can. So if your guiding principles are in the quality of execution, doing it as well as you can, that becomes your sort of ethical base within your creative process.
Briefly touched on at the beginning again, but innovation and technology, it's not immediately obvious that this would be, given what you're originally perhaps most famous for and the artisans in China, but you've always been really open to innovating and see your craft as constantly innovating. Can you talk through that journey?
Again, we use technology where it produces the best result. So we do use print. And by print, I mean digital print. Very large machines, expensive, huge behemoth of a machine. It's really exciting to use something like that when you cannot use handmade in an economically, you know, sound sense. For instance, working on 15 years ago, an exquisite background, which required about 20 different layers of varnish and tint. Beautiful finish. Absolutely impossible to reproduce consistently or sell at a price which rewarded the amount of work that went into it. So it was shelved for years, and I mourned it until we had the printer. And the printer could reproduce this extraordinary background by being fed hand-painted originals, being manipulated by a very skilled design studio, using these as layered files, and then being printed, then being over-varnished. That was a far more beautiful product, and obviously economically viable. So technology is really exciting when it can deliver something that you just cannot do by hand.
I think, I mean, you know, to continue there, but your point is, you know, the printed version is a better product because the necessities of the product are not just, is this beautiful? Yeah. Is it reproducible? Is it consistent? And, you know, there's all of those different criteria between if whether this is a good product for it, for the end purpose of the product. So, you know, you embrace technology for that. So for us, embracing digital was a step. You know, technology is the use of tools. You want all of the tools in your arsenal, but you need to know how to use them with serious discernment. We believe we've done that in the digital print capabilities, which are evolving all of the time. We, you know, we bring them in as another one of the tools which we have as any craftsman or artist who's working to create an end use, an end result. AI is a really interesting one in the same in that sense, and we have the same. I have the same excitement out of it. There's a need to get under the skin of it, understand better how we utilize it as a tool. But of course, we should embrace and utilize it as a tool. Of course, we should. But it's what you're trying to do with it. So if we took digital print as the example, if you're using digital printing instead of painting to achieve, you know, obviously reducing the number of hours, there's a cost point, understand that completely. But if you're doing it to try to remove or instead of another skill, it feels a little bit less creative, constructive in some sense. And AI will be the same. You know, if you can use it, as you were saying, to reduce some of the tasks, which really were just, they weren't value-adding tasks. They were just necessary tasks which needed to be done along the way towards the key point of being creative, the key point of producing something good. And I think if you start trying to use them to remove the initiation of an idea, the creative element there. So discernment, editing, refining, all of those questions come into it. AI is a tool to remove the repetitive task.
But it's certainly not a tool to replace the first creative spark. That's, we don't need it. I think we've proved ourselves as humans over millennia that we're pretty good at the creative spark. That's fine.
If there's one thing our raw creativity can do is come up with more than enough ideas. I mean, come on, we don't need anyone to help us with ideas. We need to help us with delivery of those ideas well.
What I would like to ask is to talk about luxury, obviously a topic we talk about all the time. Would you say what you produce is affordable?
No, it's a very expensive product. It really is, because it takes a long time to make beautifully. It's as simple as that. It's not, we're not adding value to something that is churned out in 5 minutes and spat out by a machine at all. And I know that, you know, in the luxury industry, I'm afraid there are products which are like that, which are assigned a value which really is not intrinsic to the object itself. Whereas, yes, our wallpaper, our tapestries, our accessories are expensive because they take a lot of time, a lot of skill with beautiful materials, quite simply.
What about the concept of value, though?
See, I would come to that a slightly different way. I think some of the things, some of the most beautiful pieces in our collection, some of the ones with a full hand embroidery, they're really not affordable for many people. I think that, you know, whereas at the if you like the lower end of that, I think even at the lower end of that, if you're looking at a beautiful printed only wallpaper that's going to completely transform your room, being about £5,000 or £6,000. I think for the value and reward you get in terms of the improvement of your life and the transformative effect it can have on your day-to-day environment, I think that is affordable. Not for everybody. Okay. Do outside of that in terms of value exchange. I think if you go for the £20,000 room painted on silk by our head artist, embellished in the most beautiful way, compared, I think the amount of value you will gain in quality of your life and joy over a long-term period, it's a far better investment in the quality of your life than a lot of other ways you could spend the same money. When you embark on commissioning something which you're intending to live through, it should be there for at least 10 years. At least 10 years.
It's a bit disappointing, just 10 years, isn't it?
It's the opposite of throwaway.
Yeah, almost going above that luxury. What is your concept? What's your definition of luxury? You're clearly a luxury good, a luxury product, luxury service.
I have thought about this a lot, so I woke up at 5 and jotted it down. So it's really two little paragraphs. The first is my perception of luxury being anything that goes far beyond the basic necessity. You know, basic necessity for shelter is a tarpaulin. Beyond that, you have a wall. Beyond that, you have a painted wall, a papered wall, a wall embroidered in silk. It's really way beyond what is the bare necessity. And then on a personal viewpoint from a creative, it's luxury is having the skill, the time to produce something of beauty and of value. It's quite simple for me how it feels. It's probably very reductive, but that's how I feel. Yeah.
I think for me, on a very personal level for me, freedom of time, the opportunity to express oneself and make choices to do the things which I love to do, that is a luxury for me. And I think, you know, Fromental creates luxury for me because I answer life's necessities through the act of doing something which I love. If I was coming from, I love being able to surround the room I'm in with beautiful wallpaper, and that to me is a luxury, which, you know, is almost one of the reasons we built the company, is to achieve these things, which are in many cases would be a luxury for others. But I think what is luxury for me, I think it's that freedom of time and the freedom to choose one's way.
Within that time. Yes, because you could be serving life. Yes, that's not the best use of your time.
And I have to also ask, you're both very much at the beginning stages of your bit. No, you're not. But you've been doing this for 20 years.
We're only 50.
God, we're to get so much better, yeah.
Where are you heading in the next 10 or 20 years? Where do you want it to head?
Well, it depends if it's on a Fromental level. Keep on making and designing different things as we go along. Accumulating knowledge, which will mean that each wallpaper is more beautiful than the last or different or exciting. What about you?
I think it's, you know, the exciting question is always, what can we do next? You know, the last few years we set up the needlepoint and tapestry and all sorts. And the fact that we could do it without, you know, with a freedom of choice, which meant it doesn't have to succeed. And I think over the next 10 or 20 years, I would like to just carry on with that same sense of exploration, not with an end point in mind to work towards, but with a greater and greater freedom and belief and desire to just see what we can do next. I don't have a clear vision for it, but making is innate to us. Seeing ideas become real. And an important part of them becoming real is making them commercially viable. There's a necessity to that. So I really would just continue with the same ethos we have now. I don't see it slowing down or stopping.
Does recognition drive you both?
Again, I think the recognition is just a commercial necessity. Well, I don't know. I mean, when we sit down and make something, I mean, whether it's my personal work or the work at Fromental, if it delights somebody, that's recognition. Yeah. If somebody sees it and recognises themselves in it, that's recognition.
We had a piece which was selected, and it was one of our original pieces from 2005, 2006, when the Cooper Hewitt discovered us at an installation we created in Milan. And to have a piece when they'd gone through every piece in our collection and place it in their permanent collection. And that feels like a recognition, not for just the beauty of the wallpaper, but a kind of legacy element to what we've created. It was Fromental that was in that. We are deeply ingrained in that. We are knowledgeable and curious and informed on the heritage and the history of decorative arts, and we love many aspects. So yes, to be enfolded in that and to be recognised as part of that ongoing story, that is really satisfying.
Do you know what? I just love that. It was just a great overview of what you do, what you think, how the business started, and some of the wider topics we love to talk about around luxury, etc. And I think it's also just really enviable because you've clearly kept a balance between a successful business and the purity of what you do, and the motivation behind it is really clear. So thank you so much. Now, we ask the same four questions on the way out to all of our guests, and we're going to ask them as well. Feel free to take one each or both respond. The first question I'm going to ask is, what most irritates you about your industry?
I am so handing that over to him. We're both curmudgeonly, but my God, he's really good at it.
To be honest, it's the bit that really gets under my skin is what's new? It's this perpetual desire, whether it's from the press or the whole industry and the whole structure, as if there's only validity to what's new.
Yes.
Absolutely. I know, I think there's a need for an evolution and an evolution in time. But this idea that only what's new is valid, even within our own business. Some of our best pieces, I still take them out to present with. I made that panel in 2006. Of course it's still valid. We're speaking about timeless things here. We're speaking in the context of a slow development of the beautiful, fast and slow-moving developments of beauty. What's new is absurd as an important question. And when that's focused on, and also when, you know, we're speaking about sustainability, the idea that what's new, what's now, what's speaking to you now, it could easily be something we made 5, 10, 15 years ago. That bothers the hell out of me.
That's a good answer. What most concerns you about the world we're leaving the next generation?
Well, I think we had a little chat about it this morning with Tim, and I think what concerns us is the
loss of nuance.
The fragmenting of everything, the fragmenting of discourse, the loss of nuance and the unwillingness to listen.
The polarisation of ideas and the partisan nature through media, politics. It's leading to a culture which will not be able to tackle the really important things which are going on, the ideological issues which lead to war, the demonization of anyone who isn't in my camp of I'm right, they are wrong, and the climate. All of these things, even AI, I'm not worried about AI. I'm worried about our lack of discernment and wisdom to navigate how we can use it. And if we don't remove that polarization and that partisanship with the realization of nuance and the lack of a black and white polarization, that's the greatest threat across all of those major sort of meta crises.
Now, the penultimate question, I'm going to stop Fromental as of now, and you've both got to get another job. What would you both do?
Well, in the background, I do my own work, which is textile art, and I would probably lead a very precarious financial life pursuing the work that absolutely consumes me when I'm not at work and I put my daughter to bed. So I would do that and somehow live off the meager proceeds. Yes. I would, yes, in a heartbeat.
I think on the practical concerns, I think the only thing I'd do would be start another business and make and just figure out another way to build another engine for that in terms of commercial and financial necessities. What I would do if I had more freedom of time and if I had that sort of, you know, what would I explore? I think it would be more introspection into the real ground of creativity and imagination and how nourishing that is, probably through a deeper exploration of psychedelics and what that would do in terms of the ongoing exploration of what it is that defines me, who I am, what I do and why. I discover that to a degree through work, but I would just dive deeper into myself for that same search.
That's one of the better answers we've had to that question. That's interesting. Finally, just personally, we like to leave it on a bit of an upper. And just personally, it doesn't necessarily have to be business. What excites you most about this most immediate period, the next few years?
There is always change. I'm always excited. It's terrifying and exciting. Yeah, change for me.
Yeah, I think funnily enough, I'd revert back a little bit to what I was stating there. I think there's a wider desire for more meaning to react to the crisis of this growing, accelerating change. And I think, you know, we're at one of those points. Humans are incredibly creative at finding solutions when our back's against the wall. The way that many of these crises are moving forward, our back's against the wall. I think I'm excited to see how the best of us respond to that.
Lizzie, Tim, thank you so much for that conversation. It was great.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. This has been What the Lux. You can find us on socials at MatterOfForm and drop us any questions or comments on Twitter using the hashtag WhatTheLux. And if you're a luxury brand looking for strategy or design that goes beyond the banal, get in touch via hello@MatterOfForm.com and chat to one of our consultants. And so, until next time.